the Russians have unveiled a new nuclear missile. It's not just a nuclear armed missile. It is a nuclear powered and nuclear armed missile, the Burevestnik, or the SSC X-9 Skyfall, as NATO is calling it. Any way you want to wrap it up, though, it's not a good thing for peace and security on the planet that these things continue to go ahead, that the saber rattling continues on both sides of the equation, both on the West and in the on the Russian side. And we're going to try and break down a little bit about what this missile is, what it may mean for global security, and where this whole issue going all the way back to, don't forget, there's actually still a war going on between Russia and Ukraine, and we'll see how all this fits together. And we have back with us today Colonel Jacques Beau, who is a former Swiss Strategic Intelligence Service officer and a former NATO officer. Colonel, welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for inviting me again to your show. Thanks. Thank you.
Well, listen, let's just jump right into this because there's you know, a lot of concern here about this this new nuclear missile which Russia has fired. They said it it'll go it went 14,000 kilometers, but that was apparently not the max range. That's just as far as they decided to fly it. It had multi-hour flight time. It was powered by a nuclear engine, which I have never heard before. And apparently, according to the Russians, it's the first time there's ever been one like that. What do you make of this missile?
Well, first of all, it's not completely new. I mean, it's the first time it has been officially presented. But, I mean, all the experts knew that it was on the drawing board. And the fact that you already have a NATO name for that is just demonstrates that this is not entirely new. Now, what is new is that they tested the missile. During the test, it performed 14,000 kilometers range, mostly circling around because they, in fact, it was a trial. So they tested maneuverability of the missile and things like this. But it's like a nuclear submarine. The idea of being nuclear powered is that it doesn't depend on fuel. I mean, it depends on fuel, obviously, because nuclear is a fuel, but not conventional fuel, meaning that its range, as stated by the Russian official information, is unlimited. And this is interesting because, in fact, it resurrects somehow a concept that was developed by the Soviets in the 1950s, which was the multiple orbital bombardment system, MOBS. And the idea was that you would put a nuclear bomb in a satellite, and this satellite would be in orbit, circling around the Earth, and then you can decide to take it down on a target. And there was a variant of this, which is the fractional orbital bombardment system. Here, I made a small sketch of that just to illustrate the point. And here you have. Unfortunately, there's some French words, but the idea is that in the white dotted line is a conventional ballistic missile, if you want. And here in the yellow dotted line shows the possible trajectory of those a fractional orbital bombardment system. That means you put a bomb in orbit, it will then circle around the Earth, and it would strike then where you want it to strike. In fact, well, in that case, it was not nuclear power. It used the gravitation as a normal satellite to bomb. And this system was abandoned by the Soviets because of the Outer Space Treaty. And this system would be in breach of this treaty. It has never been, to my knowledge, developed operationally, but that was an idea, that was a concept. Now, the thing is that with this Burevestnik missile, we have exactly the same thing. with the difference being that instead of having a missile that would be in orbit, this missile would travel at 25 to 100 meters from the surface. So at extremely low altitude as a normal cruise missile. But the principle is still the same. That means that if you consider, if I take the example of the United States, for instance, where you have basically anti-ballistic detection system all around the United States, but obviously mostly in the north of the country and in Canada, that is the best covered area, meaning that such a missile could strike the United States from behind, if I can put it that way, and select probably the spot where it's less monitored by early warning systems. So it's a system that is obviously extremely dangerous if it works as the Russians say. And it's definitely, to some extent, a game changer, because obviously it offers new options for the Russians. So it travels at a speed of something like 800 to 1300 kilometers per hour. So it's supersonic at best. But so it's not hypersonic, but nevertheless, it's something that can travel enormous distances, and for that, it is a very dangerous system. So it's now, a super Tomahawk.
Because the Russians are certainly claiming that it's can't be knocked down. As a matter of fact, let me kind of put up here. Here's what General Gerasimov said to Vladimir Putin in the very much publicly televised statement of its capabilities.
I am talking about the test of the Burevestnik cruise missile with a nuclear power plant that no one else in the world has. Comrade Supreme Commander, such a test was conducted on October 21st, that a multi-hour flight of this rocket was carried out, which it covered a distance of 14,000 kilometers. And this is not the limit. With a nuclear engine? Yes, with a nuclear engine. And the tactical and technical characteristics of the Burevestnik missile generally allow it to be used with guaranteed accuracy against highly protected objects at any distance. And thus its high capabilities for bypassing missile and air defense systems were demonstrated.
On that last point there about bypassing missile defenses, the implication that many are making is that this is a game changer, as you said a second ago yourself. Also, you know, it's something that can get around the defenses in the way that you mentioned there. But when you look at even the conventional, the MIRVs and the multi maneuverable warheads, et cetera, the missiles that can come in at hypersonic, I mean, for the most part, the especially strategic nuclear arms already can't be knocked out by any country. Isn't that relatively accurate?
Well, this one is a cruise missile. So it's not, when you're talking about MIRVs and things like that, you refer probably to those multiple reentry vehicles of ballistic missiles. They have a limited maneuverability, and therefore they can be hard to hit in the terminal phase of the flight. And that's what we have seen, for instance, in the attacks performed by Iran on Israel last year and this year. You could see on certain pictures or certain movies that before reaching the ground, the reentry vehicle just maneuvers very quickly and thus prevents an anti-ballistic missile system to hit them. And it's a kind of terminal maneuverability, but they travel at extremely high speed, meaning that it prevents a missile like Patriot or THAAD to hit them, but it's a very limited maneuverability. Here we are talking about a cruise missile. So it's like a Tomahawk, but with extended range or unlimited range even. But essentially, it's very similar. I mean, I guess I don't know the details, but I can assume it works exactly or very in a similar way as a Tomahawk. Now, for these kind of missiles, obviously, when if you want to detect them or even intercept them, detect them, not intercept, but detect, you don't only rely on ground radars, but you also use a satellite-based detection system. And that's what you have also in the United States. I mean, you have satellites that monitor the space, and those cruise missiles, which are hardly detected by ground radars, they can be detected from above if you want. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on that, and there are probably more people who are much more expert than me to assess the efficiency of these detection systems and the availability of these systems, because I don't know if they are permanently permanently above United States. I assume so, but I don't know. Again, I'm not an expert in that. But meaning that it's not impossible to detect them. It's not impossible to intercept them, but it's extremely difficult, especially if these missiles come from an unexpected direction. You know better than me that the U.S. has an extended early warning system ranging from the very north of Canada to your border of your country. And these systems are obviously directed towards the Russia, I mean, through the North Pole.
Yeah. When you're talking about whether it's a cruise missile type platform or an Oreshnik type platform, a hypersonic, et cetera, some of these even standard ICBMs that both the United States and Russia have, if you're talking about especially a nuclear triad, and who knows, maybe this is a new leg of the deterrence, maybe this is a new category even instead of just the normal triads. But it seems to me, though, that in terms of the ability of a nation to defend against all of the categories, there is no defense. I mean, if somebody is concerned and they want to have nuclear weapons fall in your territory, there's too many options and too few even capable defensives. Is that relatively accurate?
Yes, we can say something like that. And also, if we talk about, for instance, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the so-called ABM Treaty that has been scrapped by the U.S. and now by Russia recently, this Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty provided for the protection for selected objectives, and especially capital cities or the command posts of the two countries, but prevented by treaty, it was prevented to have a full protection of the population, because the idea is that the nuclear weapons could still play a dissuasion role. And the idea of protecting only the capital city is to preserve the command post, to avoid a decapitation strike, because if you have such a strike, then obviously you then it's unlimited catastrophe. If you know you need to have an ability to negotiate at the last minute, hence the so-called hotline between Moscow and Washington, and the ability, all the crisis management system that could allow, in a case of inadvertent launch, accidental launch, or any reason for having an unintended launch, that you can still protect the command centers. That's extremely important.
So let me ask you this: if we can generally agree anyway that the ability to blow each other up with nuclear weapons of many different classes and categories, if either side wants to, the other side can get through, period. So that is not changed. This doesn't change any of those dynamics because they already existed. But what do you see as the real concern about the elevation of this new capability? Does that increase the risk of nuclear escalation?
No, not really. But I think the idea of, I mean, again, it was on the drawing board since probably years, obviously. But the very fact that the Russians decided to present it officially those days is probably related to the threat that they perceived with the Tomahawk. I think that's the thing. And in fact, if we look carefully at what happened last year, about 1 year ago, we had almost exactly the same scenario. You may remember that in October last year, the Ukrainians launched a strike, eight attacks, a strike on Bryansk. And that was quite unexpected because Bryansk is at 120 kilometers from the border. And the attacks missiles that have been provided to Ukraine have a maximum range of 150 kilometers, meaning that the Ukrainians had to get very close to the border to launch the missile, which is something they usually don't do. Normally, when you launch such a missile, you keep a security, a safety distance, if you want, in order to avoid artillery fire. And for that reason, you fire your missile from a distance of about 70, 80 kilometers from the border at the closest, in order to avoid artillery. And for that particular strike on Bryansk, they came unusually close to the border. And at the same time, in the media, you had this information that Biden had authorized long-range strikes or long-range strikes in Russia. My person, and which has never been confirmed by the White House at that time, by the way. My personal view is that Biden never allowed long-range strikes in Russia. They allowed it, they made an exception in May last year, in order to be able for the Ukrainian to counterattack in the area of Kharkov, when the Russian launched their offensive in the area of Kharkov. And here they allowed what they call an ops box that's about 50 kilometers deep into Russian territory to use those attacks and other U.S. missiles or, yes, missiles where the U.S. are involved in. And but they never allowed the use of attacks deeper into Russia. And in October last year, probably Ukraine tried to force its way or to force Biden to allow it. And that was the reason why they made this. And that was a single case. I mean, this has been a one shot. And then we never had such strikes with attacks. They made a lot of attacks with drones and things like this. But this didn't involve U.S. technology or U.S. equipment. But with the attacks, that was to my knowledge, the only one. And then as a response to that, the Russians fired the Oreshnik missile on the Yuzhmash plant in Dnipropetrovsk. And this plant, in fact, was one of the plants that produced another ballistic missile of the Ukrainians, the Grom-2 or Grom-2. That had been presented earlier last year officially, and that was able to reach Moscow, and the Russians took the opportunity to strike on this Yuzhmash production facility. They also struck other production plant for this missile, but that was the opportunity for Russia to present officially, if I can say, the Oreshnik missile, which was as this one, which was still under development. This is not a full production missile. The Oreshnik at that time, today it's in full production apparently, but at that time it was still under development as the Burevestnik. So the Russians take opportunity when they see a threat to show to the U.S. especially, that they have also something that may cause some worries in the West. And I think it's important because so far, The Russians have never flagged the nuclear threat before they received a threat from the West. And the first occurrence of that was on the 24th of February, 2022, when that was the start of the special military operation, as you know. And on that very day, Jean-Yves Le Drian, who happened to be the French defense minister, threatened Russia by saying that NATO was a nuclear power and that it was, I mean, obviously was flagging the nuclear threat on Russia. And Russia then raised the level of alert of its strategic nuclear forces. Very slightly. It was not that threatened, but it was a political signal more than an operational one. And later we had this that was repeated, especially in that was in the summer 2022, when Liz Truss, who used to be the prime minister of the foreign minister of the UK, and when she applied for being a prime minister, she was interviewed on the UK TV. And when the journalist asked her if she was ready to launch or to start a nuclear war against Russia, she said yes. And when the journalist asked him if it was for global annihilation, she said yes. So, you know, when you have...
You didn't keep that job very long.
Well, this explains that probably. But nevertheless, it shows how our politicians are extremely light-footed when it comes to talking about nuclear.
Well, speaking of light-footed and politicians talking about things, let's take a look at the American half of this, because naturally, as soon as this was publicized and the Russians intended everybody to see it, all the cameras went to the White House, at least on the Air Force One, to ask the President of the United States what he thought about it.
Russia said this week that they tested a new missile that can go more than 8,000 miles. Is that saber-rattling for you? What is that?
They know we have a nuclear submarine, the greatest in the world, right off their shore. So, I mean, it doesn't have to go 8,000 miles. And, they're not playing games with us. We're not playing games with them either. We test missiles all the time. But, you know, we do have a nuclear submarine. We don't need to go 8,000 miles. And I don't think it's an appropriate thing for Putin to be saying either, by the way. He ought to get the war ended. That's what he ought to do instead of testing missiles.
Okay. Now, obviously, there is some accuracy to that. We do have submarines off the coast of Russia. Russia has submarines off of our coast, no doubt, or at least they do patrol periodically. So, again, none of the calculations have changed, but when you hear that kind of cavalier spot, like, oh, yeah, well, I got nuclear missiles on my subs off their shore, so, you know, so shut up. I mean, what are you to make of it?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, Trump created that situation by having this kind of ambiguity with the Tomahawk missiles. I mean, that was yes, no. Zelensky asked for them. Zelensky asked for Tomahawk missiles already earlier this summer. That was in July or something like that. Then he came back on 23rd of September asking for those missiles. And Trump, instead of saying a straight no, he just said maybe and probably and things. So he creates some kind of ambiguity. And the problem is that he wants also to solve the problem in Ukraine. So if he wants to have a very honest and frank relationship with Russia, he needs also to be frank also on that issue. And my personal view is that he should have made very clear from the very beginning that he was not ready to provide a weapon that is inherently destabilizing, because the problem of the Tomahawk is that it is nuclear capable, meaning that if the Ukrainians want to use that, if you look at it from a Russian perspective, I mean, how can you know that this particular missile has no nuclear warhead. And therefore, it would be tempting for the Russians to respond straight away with nuclear missiles. So this is a very destabilizing situation. And for that reason, I think Trump carries a lot of responsibility in this current crisis. And in fact, pressed or pushed the Russians to make kind of a stop in the discussion by saying, well, if you threaten us with yes and no and maybe and not maybe, and you know, never know exactly where you stand, if you threaten us like this, we have something to respond.
And as it turns out, at least according to the Russians, it isn't just the Trump stuff, though how could it not be, as you say? But according to Dmitry Peskov today, there's some European elements of this as well.
Россия последовательно занимается обеспечением собственной безопасности. Именно в русле этой задачи и происходит разработка новых систем вооружений, к коим относится вот озвученная система. Обеспечение безопасности для России является вопросом жизненно важным, особенно на фоне того милитаристского настроя, который мы сейчас слышим от европейцев в первую очередь. Европейцы действительно находятся в состоянии такой внутренней истерики, русофобской, агрессивной и воинственной.
So for those who may not be able to read those words at the small bottom of the screen there, he's basically saying, listen, we have our European security is very important to Russia, and we are getting lots of bellicose statements and talking about rearm Europe. They're talking about moving troops closer. The German troops are actually in the bolts already. You have the French leader, military leader claiming that, hey, we could be at war with Russia pretty soon, so we got to get ready. Britain's saying the same thing. Is that just rhetoric, or how does that affect the continental security system?
Well, it's rhetoric, but it has also an impact on the political decision making. You see, and there is also something that I didn't mention, but probably needs to be taken into account. Remember that a couple of months ago, that was earlier this year, Zelensky apparently told Trump that he was ready to have nuclear weapons. And they were, in fact, working on having their own nuclear weapons. So that was, in fact, when Zelensky said that, that was short before the RIM-2, the GROM-2, the missile I just mentioned before, was presented publicly. So I don't know exactly if the Ukrainians are working on that or if it was just a declaration from Zelensky just to blackmail the Americans in a certain sense, but by saying, if you don't give us weapon, then we'll go nuclear on our own. I don't know exactly what was behind this, but what we can see is that the situation that we are seeing on the battlefield now in Ukraine shows or provokes for the Ukrainians kind of a trend towards escalation. And we have the same thing on the European side, because the Europeans apparently have no moderation effect on the whole conflict. I mean, at least, even if we can, I'm not sure Trump is extremely effective in his attempt to stop the conflict, but at least he tries something. At least he has started a dialogue with Russia. At least he met Putin. At least he had several meetings with both Zelensky and Putin. He had also a phone conversation with them. At least that. It was not very effective so far. Okay, but at least he's doing that. On the European side, on the other hand, those people are absolutely not in favor of any kind of negotiation. On the contrary, they are trying to escalate the conflict. And since they are not able to provide additional weapons, they are trying to use other weapons, such as sanctions, freezing, not freezing, but seizing, literally, the Russian assets. So there is in Europe a kind of hysteria, and I think that's a word that Peskov is using, which is, I think, totally legitimate in that case. There's a kind of hysteria in Europe to try to escalate the conflict, since they see that the situation is going more dramatic every day on the battlefield. They can't do anything. They don't want to negotiate. They don't want to allow Zelensky, because remember that Zelensky tried on three occasions to have a political settlement of the conflict, and on the three occasions that was prevented by the Europeans themselves. So meaning that the Europeans are completely in a kind of mood to escalate the conflict, and I'm not sure the leaders in Europe have realized the implications for the situation, the security in Europe, in fact.
Okay, so let me ask you this question in light of that. So I think we can very safely assume that you're correct there, that the Europeans are only bent on more military support. They literally don't even talk about diplomacy. Yep. So let me ask you, from the perspective of the Russian side, and what impact that could have on the conduct and eventually the outcome of this war, if they see on the European side, number one, that there's zero interest or even much less even an effort to go into negotiate a settlement, then you back over to the United States side to use your analogy there. You know, the Trump has said yes sometimes, no sometime, maybe, whatever, on the Tomahawk missiles. But then it also extends into to the diplomacy, because on the one hand, he talks about, yes, I want to bring this war to an end, I'm tired of the killing, etc. And then on the other hand, he says, you know what, how's about we do a bunch of sanctions here? And some of Trump's biggest supporters on American media are saying that's not enough, you need to do more. Here's Jack Keane.
So where are we now? President's taken the gloves off. He said, I've had enough of this extended diplomacy. I've run out of patience with Putin. I've given him as much rope as possible. I think this is the beginning. And yes, these are real sanctions. Everyone who's looked at it knows that they are. They have to be enforced. It takes enormous diligence on the part of the Treasury and the State Department to make sure it's working. And he's got a bunch of other sanctions in the quiver, not the least of which is sending Lindsey Graham and Senator Blumenthal's proposed legislation, which would slap 500% tariffs on anybody right. purchasing Russian oil. And so, the president has, you know, that whole ghost fleet out there of tankers. The president can go after that. So he's got more to do on the sanction area.
Okay. If you're Russia and you have all these inputs, these kind of like Jekyll and Hyde inputs from the U.S. and the only Jekyll inputs from the European Union, obviously Zelensky, I could have used several sound bites from him just in the last couple of days, where he continues very consistent, has no interest in a negotiated settlement, anything short of his outcome, which is never going to happen on the other side. So what then is left for Russia? How do they make sense of all this very convoluted Western side?
Well, I think Russia will do exactly what they are doing. That means they will increase the pressure on Ukraine. They will continue to destroy completely Ukraine, in fact, but they will not give up with a political solution. Remember that the mindset of military doctrine or a military approach of war in Russia is that war is the continuation of politics with other means, meaning that you can always shift from war on the ground to politics. And that's exactly what we have seen in the past. The Russians have been very consistent into that. If you come with a political solution, they will slow down on the military. If you don't have a political solution, they will increase the pressure on the military. The idea being that you will use the military to create a pressure on the Ukrainians. That was exactly the idea of reaching Kiev in February 2022. That was not to take Kiev, but to put pressure on Kiev, on the government, to engage into negotiation. And in fact, it's exactly what happened, because the special military operation started on the 24th of February. On the 25th of February, that means one day later, Zelensky called the Swiss foreign minister to ask organizing a peace conference, meaning that this idea of combining military pressure with political solution is something that the Russians will always do. The problem is that since obviously the Russians feel that there is no result on the politics side, they will increase pressure. And that increase of pressure gives more room for the hawks in the Kremlin, because as we know and as you know, the Putin is not the more radical, and you have a lot of other politicians in Russia that in fact are asking Putin to put more pressure on Ukraine to attack much more and to destroy much more Ukraine. In fact, it's Putin that is pulling the brake, because he doesn't want to destroy Ukraine. That was not his objective. Remember that in April 2022, he was ready to withdraw all troops from Ukraine in exchange of the neutrality of Ukraine, meaning that for Putin, the destruction of Ukraine is not on the agenda. The problem is that since he has no other mean to exert some kind of pressure on Ukraine, he will continue to do so. And if the hawks in the Kremlin manage to convince him, I mean, that can escalate the conflict. I think Putin is resisting that, and probably this presentation of the Burevestnik missile is probably the illustration that he prefers to show some muscle without going too hard against the population, even if
I want to camp on that for a second before we get off of that, the point you just made here, because I think it is so vital for our audience to understand, and even more vital for the West to understand, and we don't. And that is the motivation. You just said it was not in the cards. Russia did not intend to conquer all of Ukraine at the beginning. You said that many times on our show, and the evidence certainly concludes that. But when you listen to what the West is saying, they seem to have, I don't know whether they're just saying this or they actually believe it, but in any case, their actions are predicated on it. Here is Jack Keane again framing what he thinks is the Russian objectives.
Putin's objectives are to topple a government in Ukraine, take the country over, use that as an anchor to expand into Eastern Europe. How do we know that? Because that's what he said time and time again. He's got two false narratives out there to support him in that. One, the justification for doing it in the first place, because NATO is encroaching with the new Eastern European members that they took on beginning in the 1990s, who used to be part of the Soviet Union, didn't want any part of being part of Russia going forward, saw them as a threat and wanted the protection of NATO. Putin turns that around and says, Eastern Europe is encroaching on us. And that is a security problem that we have. That is absolute rubbish. But there's people in the United States who have bought into that false narrative.
See, it's all the, I mean, he goes, they keep saying it. No, they actually don't keep saying it. They say the opposite. As a matter of fact, here is just one example. Also, maybe even from today. I think it might have been from today or yesterday, where Lavrov said very clearly, it's not about territory. It's about people.
But we could never think that the people who live on these territories, which you listed, which are now in our constitution, that these people would be considered second sort, especially after the coup 11 years ago in February 2014, when the putschist took power by illegal bloody coup. It is not for territories for us. It is about the people who have been living on those lands for centuries.
So if you have mentalities that are so polar opposite and what the West thinks, and I think a lot of people, whether Jack Keane actually believes that or not, maybe secondary, lots of people do genuinely believe that Russia's just out to conquer everything because that's in their nature, et cetera. And then the Russians are saying it's always been about the people here and it remains. If you have those kinds of construct, the mental construct, how is it even possible to get to an end of war negotiation short of the Russian side winning on the battlefield?
Well, asking the question is answering the question to some extent, because when you see generals, I mean, you are military. I used to be a military. When we make a decision as a military, we tend to base our decision on facts, not just on fantasies. And here we have a general that makes an assessment based on fantasy. The Russians have never said they would take over any, not even the power in Kiev. And I think the Russians would, by all means, to avoid this, by the way, and certainly not to attack any country in Western Europe. They don't even reacted when the Baltic states joined NATO. The problem that became a concern about NATO was when the US, after scrapping the ABM treaty that we mentioned before, the Bush administration started to engage with Poland and Romania in order to deploy anti-ballistic missiles on their territories. And as you probably know, those anti-ballistic missile systems that are deployed in Romania and in Poland are also suited for ballistic missiles, meaning that if you see that from Moscow, there is an uncertainty about what is in those silos. And that created the problem. That's exactly the same scenario that we had as Turkey joined NATO in 1952. I mean, the Soviets were not pleased about this, but they didn't react. The reaction came in 1962 when the US decided to deploy nuclear missiles in Turkey. And that was the trigger for the Cuban Missile Crisis, because then the Soviets said, okay, you want to put missiles there, we put missiles in Cuba. And that created this situation. And later, the crisis was, at the last minute, solved. The Soviets didn't deploy their missiles in Cuba, but the US had to withdraw their missiles from Turkey. So we have exactly the same thing. It's not NATO as such which is the threat. The problem is that there is this appetite from the US to deploy those missiles right at the border with Russia. That creates the problem, you see? And that's exactly why the Russians are now extremely careful about the advance of NATO. It's not just about the few tanks that you may have at the border. I mean, this is not the problem. But the missile, because when you have a ballistic missile that is stationed in Poland, obviously your warning time is extremely short. And in fact, it doesn't allow for assessment of the threat. You are almost obliged to reply or to respond directly with nuclear weapons. And that's something that is extremely destabilizing. And that's something I don't understand why the US don't understand this. I mean, not you, but those who deploy those missiles, obviously. And that's the source of the concern. Now, the Russians have always said, and that's what Lavrov is saying, the reason for coming into Ukraine was because just after the coup in February 2014, just to remind people, on the 21st of February 2014, the government made an agreement with the largest opposition parties in order to solve the crisis that was in Maidan with those riots and violence and all that. They made an agreement. In this agreement, it was planned to have new elections, presidential elections, and that the government would remove all the law enforcement and security forces that were in the streets and all that. And in order to have a peaceful situation, and then they planned also, as I said, for these elections, new elections. The problem is that this treaty, this agreement, was monitored and guaranteed by France, I mean, the French foreign minister, the German foreign minister, and the Polish foreign minister. And the day after, on the 22nd of February, the agreement collapsed because the demonstrators, who were in fact ultra-nationalists, to use a polite word, took over the government building, stormed the presidential palace, and Yanukovych had to flee. And on the 23rd of February, the first decision made by the new non-elected government was to abolish the law that made Russian as an official language in Ukraine. And that's the starting point
of the whole Civil War.
Revolution, see, almost a civil war that you had in the whole, not just in the Donbass, but in the whole of the southern part of Ukraine. From Odessa to Kharkov, you had in almost every single community or village or town, you had people revolt against the government. And from that point, the government tried to, they had not enough law enforcement units, so they committed the army. But the army was a conscription army, so half of the army was Russian-speaking, meaning that those Russian speakers in the Ukrainian army defected to those who were in favor of Russian language. And the government had to compensate by using paramilitary forces, and that's the birth of those Azov and Pravi sector and all these nationalist, ultra-nationalist militia that repressed brutally the riots and the demonstrations and all that. And that, in fact, created the situation that we have now. And
then that part of the history that you've just talked about there literally never gets into the Western narrative. The only thing we hear about is that there was a popular uprising in 2014, and all of a sudden those darn Russians, little green men, came in out of nowhere and turned it against them. And you've talked about what that really was a lot of times, but unfortunately, that is what, when the Russians keep saying the root causes, what they're trying to get, it goes back to there. They talk about that. And
exactly.
Gary, I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball here. If you can pull up the one that says Lavrov ceasefire, here in that same interview we had with him a second ago, is where he reiterates what their objective is.
The Europeans are trying to dominate the agenda with the rhetoric about ceasefire. They zigzagging, depending on what is going on the front line. Root causes, that's what must be key to understanding how to help end this situation efficiently.
So when you keep going back to both Trump, Lindsey Graham, and certainly Jack Keane a minute ago, they keep thinking, we just put enough sanctions on Russia, it'll put pressure on them, it'll bring them to the table, and they'll just decide to stop fighting. That's what Trump said. Just quit fighting where you are on the current line of contact. But the Russians have methodically and monotonously said, root causes. We have to get that solved, which you just alluded to. How do you square the circle of what the Russians think the objective is and what the Americans / the West are trying to make the objectives?
Well, the problem is, and probably the answer to your question lies, in fact, in this interview that was shown. I discussed it once on your channel a long time ago. This is the interview of Oleksiy Arestovych on the 18th of March 2019, in which he explains that since there is a open crisis with Russia, Ukraine cannot enter NATO. So that means that in order to enter NATO, you need to have a war, Russia needs to be defeated, and if there is no Russia, then there is no crisis with Ukraine, and Ukraine can enter NATO. That was the idea. And remember that Oleksiy Arestovych at that time was the personal advisor to Zelensky. And in fact, what we have seen after that match exactly with what Arestovych said on this Ukrainian TV. You don't need even to rely on what Lavrov said. I mean, the Ukrainians have said all that in reality. But we don't want even to believe what Ukrainians said. But and that's these are the root causes. And that's for that reason, you may remember that in December, on the 17th of December 2021, the Russian government issued two memorandums, one to the US government, another to the Secretary General of the NATO, to ask to stop the enlargement of NATO, because they wanted, in fact, that the US, both the US and NATO, would say a straight no to Zelensky because about the membership to NATO. Because the problem is, and you may remember, and that was witnessed by people I know in the OSCE, observers and all that. I mean, there is a lot of documentation on that, that in February 2022, the idea was to launch the war against, or to provoke a Russian intervention. And that's exactly what Orestovich said in 2019, where he even said that the war could start at the end of 2021 or beginning of 2022. So we are exactly in this, what Zelensky said. And the idea of provoking the conflict was precisely to be able to launch all those sanctions, or those massive sanctions on Russia, and to provoke the change of regime in Moscow. And just a few weeks ago, by the way, Zelensky repeated exactly that. You have to create hunger riots and things like this, and to create this regime change. And from this regime change, then the situation would be such that Ukraine would have no longer an enemy and therefore could enter NATO. And that's, you know, this idea, since 2008, there was the idea of having Ukraine into NATO. But Russia didn't provide this memorandum before. It provided precisely when it felt that things were, the tensions were was rising in Ukraine, that the conflict was about to start, and therefore it was the last minute to tell both the US and NATO to ask to tell, in fact, Zelensky that there will be no NATO, don't start a war, because regardless of what happened, you will not be in NATO. And incidentally, what happened, and you may remember that in March 2022, Zelensky said to CNN that in fact he asked Joe Biden whether Ukraine would be into NATO or not. And Joe Biden told him, the answer is no, you will not be in NATO, but for the public opinion, and if openly, we'll say that you will. So there was obviously a manipulation there in order to create a situation of tension between Ukraine and Russia. And clearly, and still today, you see that the Europeans are helping, they are not really helping Ukraine. Because we don't see exactly what they want to achieve with Ukraine. We know that the situation that we have, and many people have said that there is no way that Ukraine can recover the territory it has lost, and so on and so forth. So what is the objective, or what are the objectives of the Europeans? In fact, this is still the same one. The main objective is to weaken Russia, maybe to achieve any kind of regime change in Russia at the expense of Ukraine. And that's exactly what Lindsey Graham was even saying himself. That is the fight against Russia up to the last Ukrainian.
Yeah. And, you know, the irony is all that can accomplish is just to keep the war on life support, like an intravenous fluid. It can't win it. It can't even avoid defeat. Ultimately, it can just keep it going for a little bit longer. And then all of these big payments have to come to you, kind of like a big balloon payment. And I don't know how NATO, the West, is going to pay that bill when it comes due. But I don't see any path. In the last minute we have here, do you see any path, legitimate, viable, that this could end in any kind of a negotiated settlement, given where the West is? Or do you think it's going to have to be settled eventually on the battlefield by the Russians?
Well, the problem is that the only actor that is willing to go further into some kind of political solution is Donald Trump. The problem is, I'm not sure he's doing it the right way, because he's not.
I'm pretty sure he's not. I'll just throw that in there. So,
sorry?
I'm pretty sure he's not doing it the right way. So,
no, absolutely. We'll, I mean, he's obviously not putting the pressure where it needs. It's still sticking to some extent to this Kiss-Kellogg plan, which we know the Russians will not accept. And although after the meeting in Anchorage, apparently Trump had understood the Russian position. And the communique that was provided by Marco Rubio, that is on the White House website, by the way, on the 17th of October of August, sorry, demonstrates that the Trump has understood the Russian position. The problem is that he understands that, but he made nothing to make something out of it. I mean, it's not enough to say, okay, I understand what you said, but then he should act on this and say, okay, we scrap the Kiss-Kellogg plan, we have to adjust that or to adapt it in order to take into account Russian interests. Because the problem is that you can say whatever you want. The problem is that regardless of what you think about the Russians, they have the upper hand in Ukraine. That's a right. fact.
So then we get last 30 seconds. Then yeah. Where does that mean that this, how's this war going to be solved?
Well, I think either Trump made more effort to do what he wanted to do, or we'll have, as Josep Borrell said, he was the foreign minister of the European Union. He said, well, this conflict will have a solution on the battlefield.
That's the way my analysis sees it. And every time I keep looking at it, just looking for any kind of a viable, rational chance to have it solved somewhere else, I just don't see it for all the reasons you just mentioned. But we really appreciate you coming on and providing that clarity, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to tell the truth, even when it's something we don't really like. And unfortunately, this is one of those cases right here, but it's good to know where we actually are. So in the event that maybe it becomes clear that that's going to manifest in an ugly way, there may yet be time for people to say, okay, let's stop this before it goes too far. There's always that hope, and only because of clarity from people like you, and we really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me. Thanks.
And we appreciate you guys very much, too. Thanks. Good to be back in my regular digs here and back on a full speed. We will be back at 2 o'clock this afternoon. We're going to look at some additional aspects from that Sergey Lavrov interview that we showed before, some other comments from some Americans, and then we're also going to be looking at what in the world is going on in Venezuela. Are we heading to war there? We're going to be covering all that this afternoon at 2 o'clock. We'll see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.